you, Tony. It is a great pleasure when you invited me to come to this place. And this is my first time in Santa Barbara. I'm very happy. And my wife is also here, so we are both working and enjoying our stay here. And today I'll be speaking something that we have been doing with relativistic strong field dynamics. So two of the things would be my theme this morning. One is the strong field ionization, because when the field is strong, that's probably the most dominant of all channels where things happen. And ionization is particularly interesting as a challenge for physicists like us, is that here you have the whole continuum, and that's a tough problem. There's no comfortable set of states with which I can truncate my system directly. And the best thing in this field, I think some of you are working to develop, is to have a workable theoretical simulation that one can make out of the Dirac equation, for example. But this, as we all know, and here it was discussed, is a very tough job, the Dirac equation simulation, because of the time and space involved. Therefore, we took a different approach, the approach is this, that in the absence of accurate numbers, can we get away some insight into this difficult problem where many things happen, but what is of specific dominance and interest? And with our non-relativistic approach to this, which is a kind of S-matrix approach, essentially, I'll probably mention here, inspired, I think, by ideas of Feynman's space-time approach to relativistic quantum dynamics. So let's see. Now, whenever we talk of relativity in Dirac system, we are faced with this problem of negative energy. And negative energy is a completely new thing. And we know there are many ways of picturing what negative energy states are. So I here mentioned two very familiar ones. One is the standard textbook in the Dirac equation situation, that we have a negative energy C, and we postulate that they are fermions, therefore they have completed field, and nothing is happening. When this electron was sitting here, then it was pure electromagnetic field. There was nothing. Because these two charges cancel each other, and we don't perceive anything. But if somehow one is brought out, then as we all know, there will be a hole left, and this will behave like a real positive energy particle, so pair creation, and oppositely pair annihilation. I found that this idea of the solid-state physicist, perhaps here is a little more illuminating than this one. We have the free electron here with two energies, and it has this momentum. So it is actually the Dirac's electron's dispersion relation between momentum and energy. And if we do that, then we have a double plot. Here is the momentum, and there is the energy. So we see that actually this is like two bands, one here, the other here. This is the positive energy band, this is the negative energy band. And each one has spin. So there are actually two degenerate states here and two degenerate states there. So, and the state is defined not just by the energy where it is, but also by its momentum values, because it causes the momentum. So any point on this curve is a real point in the negative energy momentum domain, and thus positive energy momentum. So if I make a transition here, it would be allowed or not allowed depending on not only the energy is covered, but also if the momentums are balanced. And in fact, we know one photon cannot balance the creation of two particles. So we would need two. And that we could also see in this picture. Suppose the one is going this way, I'm going to go in the negative way, and you will see that the momentum energy mass balance as well as the energy mass balance. So this is another way of looking at it. A third point, a little point, is this, that how many states I have here? I have two degenerate states here and two degenerate. So there are in all four states, and this is the minimum number of states of the free electron positron system of Dirac on which I can probably construct a lowest order solution, non-perturbative, on the basis of these essential four states in the Dirac system. So I would say that those of us who are doing simulations with Dirac equation, they do this four state calculation also and see whether they significantly differ from this. And my suspicion is that unless you are such a situation that you are creating many pairs, this four state would provide a good basic understanding of the time-dependent dynamics of Dirac systems. We'll be doing this, but this is a point that I think the community can also try out and compare with the full-scale simulation, which is a hard stuff thing. But because of these difficulties with the simulation, so as I was saying, in the case of a non-relativistic situation, the solid interpretation of this negative state, energy states, is due to Feynman, who was inspired by Stueckelberg. So this Feynman-Stueckelberg approach somehow is not much talked about in our strong field community. So I'd like to draw your attention to that. That in this, I took it from his famous paper called The Theory of Positrons. It was published in 49, and he wrote a series of papers between 48 and 49, including one review in Review of Modern Physics about this space-time approach to quantum electrodynamics. I will say that for us, it's not really quantum electrodynamics, but quantum dynamics, relativistic dynamics. The difference is that we are not involved in this extremely serious question that these people were involved of what happens to self-energy of the electron and what kind of correction one needs. And finally, they resolve this by renormalizing the charge and mass of these electrons by computing the self-energy perturbative diagrams. But here, he's saying to us that actually, if we reinterpret the whole theory of Dirac as time positive for electrons and backward negative time propagation for positrons, which is the idea that was proposed by Stueckelberg, and he says that also in his paper, then we can get automatically all the possibilities of virtual and real pair formation and annihilation together with the ordinary scattering processes, including the correct relative signs of the various terms of your calculation. Now, this is a very strong statement, and it's very important, I think. And then he says, then such a particle is the amplitude for transition that can be constructed systematically as a sequence of scattering or interaction processes. So this is actually is the spirit of this matrix or perturbative theory. Now then he goes on, this is from his appendix, equivalent to the second quantized theory of holes, which was at the time being developed by people like Dirac and Pauli Heisenberg. They were quantizing the field. Second quantized, they were calling this. And he proved that in his appendix that these and this space-time approach are equivalent. These are so important things for us. So for us, for one particle system, absolutely no problem. But for many particle systems, there is a question about this electron-electron correlation term. So what happens in the quantum electrodynamics that you construct out of your theory the interaction that is going on between electron and positron. For us, when we are not interested in the vacuum-induced correction to our problem, such as, say, lampshade, which is a vacuum induced correction to the energy levels of the atom, then we, so long we may neglect the influence of the vacuum per se on the particle itself, we may take it as an external potential. This is also established in Fermi's treatment of electrodynamics, and he showed clearly that all the normally known electron Coulomb interactions between them and with the nuclear arises from the classical electrodynamics. So if we believe this, that this is true, that the Coulomb interaction arises in a particular Coulomb gauge, then we may use this as an interaction in the entire scheme, so long we cannot be perturbed by the cell energy corrections due to vacuum. This is the restrictions I think we need to mention. So with that spirit, let me look at it, what Feynman did. So to do this scheme, he introduced, and this is a most remarkable thing, he introduced this Stueckelberg-Feynman boundary condition, which we call that, where the positive energy states, let's say the two Dirac states 1 and 2 are positive energy, they're going forward in time, so they're following a retarded type propagator or Gibbs function. And the negative energy ones are going backward in time, so which are following the advanced boundary condition. And he combined these two, for these two energy states. This is exactly the idea that he converted the idea of Stueckelberg into his system. Then he showed that putting the Dirac theorems here, he can derive a very simple momentum representation of this Gibbs function, where the four momentum, p and x, x prime are four coordinates, and here is p. I copied it from something that I will show you, so there should be no n, so I put n equal to 0. So this is the standard propagator of Feynman, which you use when you do perturbation theory on the basis of alpha. Alpha, alpha square, alpha cube, or log alpha, alpha, and so on arises in the self-energy correction terms. You use this propagator, and there, you see, it's a quadratic object. So there is a plus and a minus pole, which are slightly shifted above and below, and they take full account of these backward propagating and forward propagating solutions. And actually, Feynman comments on this, that this way you have avoided a whole bunch of summation that you to separately do, as at that time people were doing, which is actually even now visible in this famous book by Heitler called Radiation Theory, where he's doing separately negative energy terms, positive energy terms, adding them, getting big cancellation. And Dirac showed that the S squared term, someone pointed out in this meeting last week, is the one that really matters insofar as transition energy is concerned. And all this is included by just taking the two together. So this led me to think that in strong field, can we do similar thing? And so this is the heart of Feynman's approach to electrodynamics. Oh, so let me set up a few notations, which many of you are already using, I think. We have a four vector, which is writing without any vectorial sign, or but the zero is the time part, which is c times t. And x is the vector, this moment. P is the total energy, p zero is the kinetic momentum. And p zero is m zero c. The zero here indicates the mass of the rest mass of the electron. Scalar products of the four vectors are these. Some people write it A dot B minus A4 B4. But this zero notation, first writing, I thought it is less confusing. Your algebra remains under control better, slightly. And to my ignorance, I always thought it is Feynman's four vector notation. Then I discovered that actually Dirac introduced this X0 CT business before Feynman. And then Feynman introduced this slash notation, that if you have a gamma matrix applying to a four vector, the scalar product you write as slash. So we can, as you know, write the Dirac equation in this way or also this way. So it looks like just playing with symbols, but actually if you want to do some analytic work, it almost be helpful. You don't get confused with summing terms and discretionizing. Let me mention another slight thing for those of us who are doing numerical work and will be doing similar things or doing similar things. You see, there is a story here. There are four absolute natural constants appearing in this system. Just an electron coupled in Dirac equation, itself free or with the radiation field. Heisenberg constant, electrostatic charge constant, velocity of light constant, the Higgs mass of the electron. So four fundamental parameters are involved in this problem. Now, operating with four parameters, doing algebra, one can confuse oneself. So better to go to a scale which is a wave number scale. So reduce charge and reduce masses this way. Then you have only two constants, E and M. Then your algebra is very nice. In the end, you just replace E and M by these true values. You have your result. This is the side point. But another point is that here all the coordinates are balanced. This is perhaps not unimportant for numerical work. For example, x, mu are the four coordinates, time and space. They're all balanced. Therefore, in a numerical computation, if I have coordinates balanced, then I have a better chance that my simulation would remain somewhat balanced. So I'm considering at the moment a completely general electromagnetic field for our purpose is essentially an envelope and the polarization. And this zeta is, or this is not psi yet. This is pi by 2 for circular, 0 for linear, and arbitrary range from minus pi by 2 plus pi by 2 is the elliptical situation. So let me now go to the famous Dirac's equation solution of Volkov, which we all know. But I would like to make a couple of small remarks on this solution. So this is a Volkov solution. So we can write it in terms of a spin. This is the phase. And if I have a constant or slowly varying phase, slowly varying envelope of the field, this object can be written like this, as we all know. Notice one thing only. If you compare this with the relativistic Volkov solution, you will see that there is a parameter lambda p here appearing, where in the case of a non-Schrodinger problem, here the parameter up, the potential, multi-potentializing. And it is multiplied by u. And u, the notation, I forgot to write it here, is omega t minus k dot r. So this is a phase factor, including the spatial part, and it is the lowest invariant phase. And that fellow appears here. So if this is proportional to up, so the time part of it gives you what we normally get in the non-relativistic case, but there is a spatial part because it's a four vector. So you get this factor exactly the same with the momentum part as well. Of course, we know that in the relativistic situation, the momentum of light is also non-zero. That is to say, we have retardation effect and so on. So just keep a note on that. I will come back next. Before I go, let me note also this fact here, that the coordinate and time has this phase in the Volkov's wave function. And this phase depends not only with the retardation that we get from n photon, but also from this parameter lambda p. And that is exactly related to n. So it's a number that is times the momentum, not just the bare momentum k that involves in the Volkov solution. That is the consequence of relativity. So the consequence of relativity is not that I'm absorbing emitting n photons. I'm also dressing them with the field strength. And in weak field, this dressing is negligible. In weak field, high frequency, this term is dominant. But in strong field and moderate frequency to high frequency, both are involved. So this is, therefore, note the appearance of this dressed momentum, as we called it before, which is the sum of the ordinary momentum, or the bare momentum, plus this factor appearing, field dependent as well as number of quanta dependent. And this is a four vector, so there is an energy change due to this, and there is a momentum change. And actually, I will briefly remark on this. I learned from Stefan from before his talk and during his talk last week that actually the influence of this has been seen in some experiment by Corkum and others, and he also apparently discussed it. I was not present here. But we noticed that and pointed out that this is going to shift something in the angular distribution, and I will come to that. But let's get a physical idea about what these Volkov solutions are. You see, this is the unperturbed energy of the electron, and there is a shift. In the non-relativistic case, this is P is the polar molecule. In the relativistic case, is the lambda P. And then there is a whole constitution of spectrum of photons with it. And these, one photon absorbed, one photon emitted, and one photon absorbed, two photon emitted, three photon absorbed, emitted, and so on. It's infinite in both sides. And the probability of all these is given by this generalized Bessel function, which I didn't bother about it. And the interesting point is that these probabilities with which these levels are occupied in the Volkov wave function, so the Volkov electron, if we talk about, has these energy levels. And I can actually interpret them as probabilities because there is a sum law for any of these generalized Bessel functions of one argument, two, or three arguments. Is always one. This I can also prove. Therefore, these are the probabilities with these states that are occupied, both positive and negative. Why don't you see all these states? Because they are virtual. There is no way a free electron can stay in this state, stationary way, to see these stationary states. It's always jigging up and down. All these harmonic frequencies. But if and you cannot conserve the energy by simply absorbing or simply emitting n photons and a free electron because of the energy momentum conservation rule. There is this, I haven't put the slide on, but one can prove it, that this is a no-go theorem. A free electron cannot simply absorb n photons or simply emit n photons. It has to have a partner, whether it is a nucleus somewhere or whether it is another emitted photon when I'm absorbing it or an absorbed photon when I'm emitting it. Then I can balance the total energy. So these remain virtual. That is to say, they are not stationary. And to see that if I provide a source of potential that will provide me momenta, these virtual states will have their signature. Now the free Volkov electron will interact with the momenta and transfer its energy momentum to balance this no-go. Energy momentum and overcome the no-go theorem. And this is actually what happens when we see the ATI spectrum. Now this is what the heights of various J things should provide. This is the first peak of the continuum. Now it is real because I have balanced the energy momentum and gone into the continuum to balance this in the presence of the nucleus. And these pictures are there. Long time ago, we did a simulation to see whether our idea that these things happen, this energy momentum absorption for multiphoton thing in strong field, already before these jump from one to another of this to that are relatives. Because these jump probabilities by dipole or non-dipole approximations at this state to the 30 watt would be very low, which was observed. But we did a calculation at this intensity and one atomic unit to see how these peaks actually appear. So this simulation, here is the polarization direction. And you see in the beginning, I'm sorry for this dark picture, there are actually some thing better than this. It's first doing things in this domain, which alone is making it to evolve into these sub-wavelengths. HR, the crest is behaving like a classical trajectory. And you can calculate from the slope, time versus distance, the velocities, and hence the momentum and energy of these, exactly balance these PKID energies. And this is computed by projecting this packet onto various continuum states. So that we see that the Volkoff's states, which were at virtual energy momenta, appears in real, as real peaks in when the energy momenta are conserved in the ATI. Now, I would like to say, because time is running out, what is our approach? The approach is that we follow Feynman, but we replace the Dirac-based Feynman propagator by Volkoff-based Feynman propagator. This is the only difference we essentially doing. But then there are other differences that will come briefly. So if we do that, some time ago I could show that actually the normal writing of the propagator of with the Volkoff solutions now here can finally be converted into this form. And now you see the connection with Feynman's propagator in the absence of the strong field. In the absence of the strong field, this function Q and Qn go to Kronecker delta Nn and Kronecker delta Bn 0. Then the whole thing collapses, these two double sum collapses, and you have the simple Feynman of this vector and this vector and this integral. So this is a correct transformation of Feynman propagator in the presence of a strong electromagnetic field. Here I'm assuming a slowly varying envelope. And I mentioned that probably that implies that the envelope is changing slower than the frequency, the frequency is that. So the next step, I go very quickly, because in the formal steps, that you convert the Dirac differential equation, partial differential equation, into an integral equation, making use of Feynman's propagator. But here is the total propagator, including other interactions, but we expand this total propagator in terms of Volkoff-Feynman propagator, then it's generated by iteration, not by perturbation, by iteration a sequence, which is the corresponding series, which Feynman called the sequence of scattering.
What's your V of I?
Okay. V of I, when I divide the Hamiltonian in the initial state, I have a atomic Hamiltonian plus the interaction.
Divide what, the Coulomb potential?
Coulomb potential is in the atomic Hamiltonian, or it depends. Suppose I'm choosing here the Volkoff spin function, these are Volkoff's initial states.
Yeah, but you have two potentials. You have the electromagnetic potential and the Coulomb potential.
Right.
So what do you put in for V of I?
V of I, whatever I have in the initial state, and V of F is the reference Hamiltonian of the final state. For example, in the initial state, I divide by unperturbed one, plus the interaction, so it would be the electromagnetic interaction in this case.
And what's V of F?
Sorry? This.
Yes.
This is what I have divided in the final state.
Oh, I see.
There it would be the Coulomb potential.
Okay.
Because if I take the final state of the Volkoff, it's the Coulomb potential. This is an important point because whichever way I divide my Hamiltonian, my perturbations has to be one-to-one with that division. This is important. So this is the strong field approximation. This is the first correction. But correction in the iterative sense, I repeat this, because it's not a perturbation theory in terms of alpha, which was the thing that
was the big problem in the ordinary. But it's still something
which
has to converge.
Nobody knows, even the ordinary perturbation theory converges.
But when you have this in the term of a series, yeah. I mean, this is a series which sometimes might converge, sometimes might not converge, when you do it in practice.
This is a very good and old question, that does this converge? I do not know, and I am not aware anybody knows. But let me put one thing. That's why I was emphasizing this fact that these are not perturbation series. Most probably, which is also not provable, these are so-called asymptotic series. And I guess Jan Michael was referring to the asymptotic series story. The asymptotic series could mean this, that the first term is something, second term could be something else, a little less or a little more. The third term is very big. So we already know this is converging. But if it is not an absolutely divergent series, which would be an asymptotic series, for example, then from the first two terms, you can already construct by Shank's transformation or Padé transformation or Borel sum, the generalized summation theorem, just using the first few terms, a very good estimate of the total sum. So this is, for example, from mathematical literature, we can learn this. For example, there's a nice book by Bender and Orszag.
Where they discuss. Could you say again what you mean by this difference between perturbation series and iteration?
Yeah. The perturbation series has a small parameter in it, which at every iteration gets into a power higher. Whereas iterative series doesn't have necessarily any small parameter.
But it's the same.
It's iteration.
As looking at it as a power series, it's the same series.
Functionally similar. Yeah, this is but what I'm saying, for example, in the perturbation series, this Vi could be proportional to alpha. Or Vf could be proportional to alpha. And then next iteration is alpha squared, third iteration alpha cubed. Here is no such thing. Here is one Vi, another Vf, and there is no power parameter with which I can define the successive transfer. This is pure iteration, not based on a single parameter. And as she pointed out, do we know the convergence? I do not, and I believe nobody knows the convergence of this thing, but they're extremely useful. And in Bender's book, he discusses the perturbation. Asymptotic series, how they could be very well estimated by Padé or Shank and others. Sorry.
Well, but in the Lippmann-Schwinger question, it's always the same V which is used.
That's what I mean, that Lippmann-Schwinger.
Where, how do you partition your Hamiltonian to get a Vi and a Vf?
That, I refer to a review work that I wrote with my students.
Because you say Bf will act on the final state.
Yeah.
And this, Vi on the initial or whatever.
Yeah, so let me just put it this way. You can write the total G, which we have in the system, as some Gi plus Gi Vi G Vf G, or perhaps
you have to partition your Hamiltonian.
I probably thought
that. That's the Lippmann-Schwinger equation for two potentials.
I have, that's what I'm saying. Yeah. You haven't shown that.
Ah, okay.
Rearranging collisions. That's right.
Exactly. And then it would be extremely useful. Let me see if I remember the reference. This is J. Fields B, 2005. We have a reference by Andreas Picard.
There's also a very nice thick book by Ron, Advanced Quantum Theory.
Right. I know the Roman's quantum mechanics, quantum theory book, but I do not know if he does it in the time dependent way. There is also other books which all they do stationary problems.
Stationary.
Yeah. But so in this review, this is what is a topical review. The details of how the partition is done and how from both sides you can come. From the
shrink.
And you iterate. Why do you
iterate?
You iterate.
A function of potentials.
Whatever you like. It's up to you.
No, then it's kind of, it's still a perturbation series.
I do not know what you mean by perturbation. What is your perturbation?
When I talk about perturbation theory, one,
talk about the new parameters.
Let me say, if I had...
It's a functional power series.
And the convergence property is dependent on how you do this partition, you know, with the Volkoffs, how you divide this final and internal.
I think these are good questions, and I think in the review we have discussed it in detail. We have shown if you expand it into one potential only, like the initial one, under what specific situations of this general expansion that is recovered. We have also shown if you do it in the finals interaction only, what under what condition you recover. So these are discussed, I think, in this review reasonably extensively. Now you tell me, those who believe in the parameter, what is your expansion parameter here? And those, and then I have also the Coulomb here, whatever that is, let's say. So, but z alpha is not necessarily here. It is quadratic and alpha. So I think perturbation expansion in power series is a good thing when you have a single parameter. It is then called perturbative iterative method. I'm dropping the term perturbative because I don't have a single parameter to expand on. Okay, so let me, Tony, you will tell me when the time runs out. I have probably more material than I can say. 30 minutes, that's not too bad.
You're supposed to go back in time like your positrons.
That's the if he allows that. So let me come to some perhaps results of what we did with that. So let me consider this problem. That's a hydrogenic atomic ionic core, like hydrogen itself or uranium 91 plus. There's one electron very tightly bound or moderately bound. And I choose here the light polarization to be circular in one sense. So it is not aligned, it has a orientation, so it goes only in one way. My reason is that in this period, we're interested in the spin characteristic in strong field of the relativistic electron in ionization. So here is my circularly polarized light coming in, this propagation direction, and the electron is getting out here, and this xy is my polarization plane, and there is a theta with which the electron is going out. Now, I'm going from a hydrogenic arbitrary z, bound state, ground state. So let me mention this who are working with the relativistic thing, that there is a way of writing the known hydrogenic ground state in a covariant form. Normally, it is written in all books that I see in a non-covariant form. For example, whether Birken and Trell, or Greiner, or Bethe-Salpeter, is written with spinors, which are cosine theta phi, sine theta phi, e to the I phi, etc. But you can, and we showed that some time ago, that you can write it in this covariant form, then it, the notation of Feynman is slash, you get a vector, which is four vector like this. Why I'm mentioning this is a technical issue, not for physical significance. You can take any form. Here's that the calculation, if you have done it, you will see that if you cannot use the so-called trace rules of Feynman, calculation becomes awful. And if I want to resolve the spin, I cannot use the trace rule. Trace rule says that you sum over all spins in the end. And trace rule simplifies enormously. But I want to study spin, therefore I cannot use this trace rule. So what can I do? And I found that if you write everything in covariant form, that half the way to use of this trace rule you can manage. And that's why finally we got the bound state also in this covariant form. And the state of Volkoff we already wrote in the covariant form. So the ultimately, if we can then write down, this is a lengthy algebra, but this is systematically doable, any spin state up to down, or down to up, or up to up, and down to down. So there are these four possibilities, as well as the strongly interacting with the light, and the electrons are going out. with respect to depolarization direction. And you see the result is very simply expressed as a matrix element on the ground state covariance and the free Dirac covariant, and all the B's are taking account of the strong field interaction due to Volkov-like solutions here. And they're essentially all B0 is the time part and Bn is the vector part of these functions. They're really pure functions, just numbers here. So you can check from here that the essential dynamics of the spins and transitions are contained in this reduced transition matrix. These are
already Lorentz gate. It is used here, I think, Lorentz gate.
Yeah, I think it is not Lorentz gate, it is Coulomb gate, you may call it.
Because A is zero.
It's a time component.
What's the difference between your four vector B sub n and the slash B sub n?
Slash is the multiplied with the gamma matrix mu. So gamma mu B mu is the slash B. I think that's the point.
How do you actually identify spin?
Yeah. What do you mean?
You mean spin J?
No, no. I mean the free electron spin, or the bound electron spin characteristic. So I had that somewhere in the
For the bound electrons, it's not
For the ground state, I have spin and a small component if I go in the LS picture of L equal to 1. But spin state is independently what a representation is. It's there. When it will be free, it will carry its spin alone. It had the spin also in the initial state. I can prepare my ground state in the spin up way. In fact, in Bielefeld, there were a group very much capable of doing that. In Munster, there was a group of Kessler. You can read his book on spin symmetric measurement, or Wright's group in Bielefeld. They were always measuring spin, whether it is atomic or free electron. But free electron, you can easily see. My electron from the bound state going out, there's nothing in the electron. When it is coming to the electrode, it has a spin up, spin down.
Yeah, that's my question. So when you use spin quantum number here, it always refers to the asymptotic free.
It's 2n. Yeah, okay. Of 2n's.
Because otherwise, you cannot do block.
Wait a second.
In the ground state, you can't divorce them to the zero. It's the same thing. I mean, but this is a coincidence
ground
with the hydrogen. For the hydrogen ground state, it's the same
ground
thing.
State.
No, ground state. I can see
ground
the spin. You see, ground state is a product. In that description, you see that this fellow is a product, and these are the spin up and spin down vectors. 1, 0, 0, 0, four components. Or 0, 1, 0, 0. This is one is the spin up, the other is the spin down. And if my apparatus is able, for example, I have a steady magnetic field, I can make my bound state hydrogen spin aligned that way.
Yeah, that's really fine. But this was my question. So you're referring to these particular states where
spin is
identifiable.
Yes, of course. Okay. Sorry.
So your field, your electromagnetic field is purely external, right? So that is not an interacting field. And my other question is, you have a high C atom, and you have a very strong driver from outside. But you may have pair production, and do you, I mean, well, not probably that's what you're going after, but do you really get all channels to be two pairs if you consider the field as a C number external?
This, I think, is a question about which channel you are looking at.
Yeah.
Suppose you are producing pairs.
Yeah.
You can still detect the electron with the up spin single electron, but that probability, this is probably an issue, is influenced by the fact that another channel of the pair is being produced. Right? So long the other channel is not producing the pairs with significant probability, I can drop that channel and look only at this channel. This is the point, that probability is not influencing significantly the channel I'm observing.
Another question. Your approach here to calculate this is a strong field approximation, right? You take
the first term is strong field approximation, yeah. Yes.
So.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, with respect to this important questions of Haji, actually, I must prepare my initial state free from disturbing fields, and final state detect also free from disturbing fields. So they are all these asymptotic states, which at the laboratory I prepared or I didn't. Okay, now let's go to the this is, I probably showed you. Now, this is a bit more detailed form of this matrix element, which is not very interesting. This is the detailed form of this matrix element. It is not completely uninteresting because it is entirely algebra in this case. Only vectors and vector products and scalar products between directions here and this magnitude of this cube here. And this we call in this paper, which is almost 10 years on the spin thing that we first wrote, called this momentum P is now getting dressed into momentum Q by the field and the retardation in the relativistic case. And these parameters are always appearing in the argument of the generalized Bessel functions, which are in Bs. So this would be, for example, my rate or probability per unit time of making this specific transition I prepared and observing. And you can see here that the time component is giving me the energy conservation of the system. It is rather an involved equation, not like the unperturbed one, because the n appears also in lambda indirectly through the delta relationship itself. So it's a working equation to solve to determine the value of n for a given intensity and frequency. But that's a silly issue. But we can always write this n omega in terms of these three factors, the binding energy, the kinetic energy, and the four Pondermotive potential. Four potential in the sense that it has to do with the time as well as the space component. So here I have for hydrogen a series of probability distributions. Here is the number of photons in 1,000 photons. So this is here 6,000, 8,000, 10,000, and so on. And these levels here are the units of intensity in atomic units. And this is a 5 electron volt. Frequency. And what you see here, that there's a decrease with the increase of the intensity. So we're in this so-called post or so-called stabilization-like domain, where actually the behavior is anomalous. Normally I increase the intensity, it gets increased, but here it is decreasing. Here the experimental question is, that have I reached them before the system has got saturated in ionization? That's an interesting issue, but I think we shouldn't go into that here. Only I want to show the dependence on the intensity. You have noticed that I have some dashed line thing on top of each of them.
Yes.
These are Schrodinger calculation in the limit when relativistic C goes to infinity. And you see, there is in the scale of this diagram, there's no qualitative difference between what you do with Dirac or Schrodinger when you were observing the photon photoelectric energy spectrum. Not much.
Yeah, but you're still at low intensity, I mean, 10 to the 16.
No, you're right.
Show me something at 10 to the 20.
Like 10 to 18.
Yeah, it's okay.
It is pretty high, also. But it depends what we call high intensity. It is a relative concept.
Why the area does not seem to be conserved in terms of peaks? I would guess that everything would be ionized and the probability should be the same. whatever it is.
Well, if you say everything is ionized, then of course it should be a saturation situation.
Yeah, yeah.
But that I referred to before, that these...
How many cycles you
have? I have a large number of cycles. Very large.
Ah, okay. It's, nevertheless, it's short.
Short, perhaps
it's not. Long.
Perhaps not short, but it's long. Okay, so let's, for André, a higher intensity story. So this is 10 to the 24. We theoreticians, once we have our machinery ready, we can go upward without much ado. And experimental colleagues will have to smile that is it realistic. But anyway, let's look at that. It's 10 to the 24 watt perspective. I have given you a 200 eV photon, perhaps from the place we are getting in Hamburg or other places. And the case here is uranium 91 plus, so that still is. And it is fantastically high intensity. Everything else is blown out, perhaps, and we are now looking at the ground state. And you see the dramatic difference between Schrodinger non-relativistic result and this very unfamiliar-looking object coming out of the Dirac. In other words, the momentum distribution, the polarization direction, is qualitatively different. And one of the reasons why it is qualitatively different, because these relativistic things are controlled by the dressed momentum, the momentum distribution, not the unperturbed free momentum. And there it depends on the field strength through UP and omega prime, which I call Doppler shifted omega, because there is a Doppler shift going on because the high velocity electron in its own frame is seeing a frequency that is not the same in the laboratory frame, shifted by the normal Doppler effect in the first approximation or quadratic Doppler effect in the second, etc. So here I come back to somewhat realistic intensity. And this is again the 200 eV, but now 10 to the 21. And this is a normal hydrogenic situation. And this is what I was referring before, and Stefan Cherkovsky made me aware in this meeting that this kind of thing has been measured by a group in Ottawa. This is the Schrodinger result, dotted one. And this is the angular distribution with respect to Dirac result. And you see the peak has moved out from 90 degrees. Remember our diagram for field propagating this way, and then this is the polarization plane. So every force is on the polarization plane. So at the 90 degree, the peaks come out. Electrons are going in the plane of the polarization, not in the direction of the field. But non-relativistically, we get that. But relativistically, we see it has got out of the plane. It's not moving in the plane mainly. Its peak is tilted by a small angle. Or in the momentum discussion, the angle is not 90 degree, but a little less than 90 degree. And here at this parameter, you see, it is not 90 degree, but somewhat shifted.
But is this mainly a magnetic effect, huh?
Okay. It is mainly, as I was saying, my just momentum, which is the momentum it is experiencing, is this lambda p times kappa minus n times kappa. So this is the retardation factor. I can actually put both of them together. So I call it, let's say, retardation effect, the photon momentum dependent effect. And you may call it magnetic. I will also call it magnetic when the magnetic field is not zero. And I discussed last time that even if kappa may be zero, magnetic field is still hanging around. Its effect may be small.
I
but
mean, you have magnetic field equal zero yet?
No. No, and it's fully Dirac. Yeah.
Exactly. So you have something.
I have my electromagnetic field is really electromagnetic field. So there is
and
an
I
effect.
Have a magnetic component.
Yeah. But here my field does not appear as a field. It is appearing indirectly here through the retardation power, which is the photon momentum. But it is not just that. As I was mentioning, this guy involves intensity and frequency as well. So the shift, this is delta P in plus A, so the shift Q minus P is this, and that depends on intensity and frequency. I probably have a slide for that. So it's all that let's change and see if this thing really is big or just always small. But you see, it is can be significant. Here is multiple monotypistic situation, the retardation is dropped a little. And here it is almost below 80 kilometers. So here is my diagram I was referring to. So this P should come out essentially non-relative on this plane, but it is tilted to certain degree, and that is this shape case from there to there. Notice in the relativistic situation, it has also got a little reduced. Here, I think, is the thing that I was trying to write down. Here's the momentum. This is the free momentum, but the Q is the momentum that is controlling the probabilities. In the presence of the field, this was Q, and that is controlling the probabilities of the system. And you see, this kappa is in the z direction in our circularly polarized field, so there's no change from that. Px and Qx are the same, so no shift in propagation direction. Z shift is only the propagation direction Z, and no change in the transverse direction, that is in the plane of polarization. And the shift amount is this. And if I look at it, which I can look, it turns out to be Up divided by a modified omega plus correction of V over C squared. And this modified omega, you can see, here is the Doppler shift-like effect, that in the direction of velocity divided by c, this ratio changes the frequency from omega, my fundamental incident frequency, to omega prime. And we noted this in this 2004 paper, that the peak values are seen to occur not on the plane of polarization at 90 degrees, but at somewhat smaller angle from it. And the change is electron momentum in field caused by the combined effect of the radiation and the field intensity, retardation of the field intensity. And this addressed momentum gives me, it depends on not only the photon momenta, but also the photon angle. And this is the picture that I got from Paul Cockum, that they have actually measured the shift as a function of intensity, and this is for one frequency, and this is for another frequency. And this result is linear, and you can see that here also, it is proportional to Up, therefore it is also linear in the intensity. So in the, it would be interesting also to compare the omega, it is inverse quadratic to frequency. And this problem is now being analyzed in great detail by Stefan Cherkovsky, and he actually made me aware that it's a measurement of this. Okay, so where am I now? I wanted to talk about spin. Now, we found an interesting effect that when we try to consider the probability that initially I'm in the up spin, that is to say, in the sense of the circular polarization positive, then and going to the down spin in the detector, there is a finite probability that I will jump to the other. But when I am initially down and going to the detector up, this is not equal. This was a bit of a surprise for me, that how come I'm symmetrically in the initial state, 50-50 distribution in my laboratory, and I'm going from the up one with a certain probability to flip, and from the down one another probability to flip. This is an interesting asymmetry.
Is this
in a Z atom, but the numbers are for hydrogen.
Okay.
So any Z
because
atom.
Oh,
yeah, this is a very high frequency. So usually, my colleagues who measure this spin flip experiment, they say that the best is to do the asymmetry parameter that look at the difference rather than absolute value is very difficult to see. So we can actually the up spin and down spin up spin. If we look at this, and you can see that the ratio of up down asymmetry is actually a very marked dependency on the angle in which these electrons are coming out. And these are two such dependencies for two different intensities, right?
These are such weak intensities.
These are weak intensities, and that still it is happening.
So the magnetic field is important even for these weak intensities.
Yes, but this is an interesting question. I actually can show that if you go to a very perturbative intensity, still the asymmetry persists. And one could ask why that, and probably I have an answer to that. So there is a strong asymmetry here, and furthermore, here's another screen. Furthermore, we can see in the transition amplitudes I wrote down the following symmetry transformation. Suppose I go from right-handed to left-handed circular, then these transition amplitudes, they transform like this, that the up-up probability goes into down-down probability conjugated, complex conjugate. So the probabilities don't change. But, and down-down goes to up-up, so they do not change. But the up-down and down-up, they change their sign and complex conjugate. So their probabilities again do not change. But what changes from this, that from up spin, you go to the down spin situation. So that you have a possibility of controlling the spin that you prefer by changing the polarization in the laboratory. For a sense of the polarization, right-handed to left-handed. So this could be an interesting thing because this effect, this switching flip of the spin and the asymmetry survives at very low intensity.
So by switching the polarization, you can make down up bigger than up down.
Right. So this would be, I think, of interest to those who are doing so-called spintronics, that by they do not want very strong field because that will destroy the system. But this effect survives at very low intensity. Therefore, they should be able to make some use of this control of the which Monte current you prefer. So that, I think, is the last topic that I today speak about, unfortunately.
Down to which intensities do you see?
Very low intensity. I mean to say perturbative intensity. Now, so that brings me to my other point, that can I understand that physically somewhat? Yeah. So I noticed the following thing. If I have this circularly polarized light with a particular thing, I have a helicity, let's say plus one, and my spin is half, so I want to go to a half spin in the end, right? Or if I have a spin up, I have a spin down here, minus half, and when I go to the other spin, I still have, you see, this case, the total m joins up to 3/2. And that is not the spin of the electron. But this one joins up to half, so that is an allowed direction of the spin of the electron. Therefore, at extremely low intensities, this probably would be zero. But the selectivity remains from up to down or up. Down to up, the asymmetry. So I think, okay, another reason that why at low intensity, we should still have the effect involving magnetic field. This is an interesting thing that effect of the magnetic field can come through what I may use the term, some people use such terms, motional magnetism or motional magnetic field. Because there is a saying in electrodynamics that because light field is Lorentz invariant, so if you look at the electric field sideways, it becomes magnetic field. It depends on which Lorentz frame you are in. So what happens actually is that you create a motional magnetic field, which is the electric field cross in certain units, P over C. So, let's move it on the side here. So this P or MC, yeah. So this motion in the frame of the electron, which is moving at a speed P, shows up, electric field in the laboratory shows up as a magnetic field. And that affects the spin behavior. So I checked in the amplitudes I had there, and where in the Dirac equation they are present? They are present in the so-called weak components of the solutions. Classically, perhaps it is related to that. And in fact, I think there is also an analogy with the Fano effect. Although it is free, and I don't have a ground state, doesn't have a spin orbit coupling, but I can still, in the continuum, due to the motional magnetic field I generate, I can influence the spin. And what I was saying is that it is in the weak component of the ground state as well as of the Volkov state. The degree of this asymmetry is determined by that. If I go to the Pauli approximation and drop the weak components, I still have 2 by 2 spin, not 4 spin. I do not get this. But I have to keep the Dirac's full 4 components. So through the weak component at weak intensities, I will still have the asymmetry. Okay, thank you for your attention.
So I'm not sure about hydrogen, but I know that there are experiments with relativistic ionization in neon and argon, probably, like 5 or 6 years ago, they were published. And of course, if you have an atom like neon, right, exposed to such high intense laser field, then what, I mean, this laser field does bad things to this atom, right? So what they showed in there is because they compared the results of the experiment with the theoretical results based on a single active electron approximation, and of course they showed that what's going on is much more than just, yeah? And I think that there is actually no theory which can reproduce the experimental results, so I think there's a lot of things to improve.
Yes, I have not seen this experiment, but what
I
you
can,
say
you is
an important issue, and for that we are there. We have to see that in this jungle, where is my effect and what particularly important aspect of our problem is producing.
I can find those references.
Okay. I've still not understood one point. So if, let's say you treat hydrogen-like systems and high C, and your motive potential of your let's say laser field is small as compared to this binding potential. So why can you not simply use the Pauli equation? I mean the non-relativistic version of the Dirac equation would probably get the same results, but the parameters that you use. That I don't understand.
Yeah. You see, as I was saying, that there are circumstances where, in this case, for example, it is likely that Pauli can get quite a lot of things right with the two-dimensional speed. But this is an example I was giving, that if I go to this situation of low intensity, binding energy is large and so on, I still will have contributions coming through the weak component which Pauli doesn't have.
But I mean, the Pauli equation is derived by expressing the small component in terms of the large component. So, I mean, this is how you do it. So, I mean, the leading effects in the small component.
If you say that, you I see your point. But then you have to produce this through this. That would be an interesting job. But let me say, after I have done this, I have no weak component in Pauli. In the Dirac, I have this kind of reactors, yeah. And these are factors here, and transition matrix element is involving these factors. They are zero in the vector notation, but in the transition matrix element, they are not zero. So my suspicion is I've actually kept the component that comes with this with the notation M1, sorry, with this with the notation M1 and this with the notation M2 to see how far these factors go in the result. Analytically to see. And finally you see that these weak components are involved. But you have a point. I mean, if I have still this M2 factor in my Pauli somehow included, I do see that, but maybe, because by eliminating, I have made the approximation in Pauli. If it is still there, which I have not seen, that would be another way of producing it. But that has to be produced.
Any final questions? Regarding this effect of change of algorithm, I would refine an El Coco experiment. And to explain Coco experiment, you must include this Doppler. I checked the SFA calculation that really Coco effect results from Doppler, not from distribution. Distribution is order of magnitude weaker than Doppler.
And that is what I was also.
But now there is another experiment in Zurich, which the situation is very different for linear quantum. Then there is shift of repeating opposite direction, and now maybe story is different.
Yes, that point, I have not calculated that yet, yeah. We have not. But I can imagine the following. My Doppler shift can be low to high pitch or high pitch to low pitch depending on the direction to the observer, motion of the source to the observer.
Yeah.
So in the linear polarization, I'm going both ways. In the circular polarization, I have particular orientation fixed. So if it goes in the opposite way, it would be interesting to see whether the Doppler shift is in the opposite direction. Huh?
Ready? Could you say again why in this uranium calculation you got this double peak?
The double peak is, how should I call it? It is that shift that we are talking about now has got so big that they have created two different humps and there is a low at the zero.
Momentum of different direction, positive and negative, yeah.
It is really dramatically distorted, this uranium at that 10 to the 24.
Maybe this is just by accident, but let's say if you could consider your binding potential as small as compared to your outside field, you know, then the intensity would be very high. Let's say, yeah, so that you have maybe hydrogen or something like this, so that the potential is not too high. And then you have 10 to the 24 watts per square centimeter. So, yeah. And then you should have a limiting case that comes quite close to what Ritus and Nicky showed. Right?
Uh-huh.
And for instance, you would then have pebble dash.
Uh-huh.
And that also shows this double.
So maybe it is a correlated thing because
if
the channel of pair production is doing something, that has also an effect on the ionization. So. I know several papers of Nikisha, but I don't recall where this problem comes in. But you can perhaps show me that. That would be interesting.
Okay. This calculation of the asymmetry in the spin field probability, that was the solution of the full Dirac equation?
A full Dirac equation in the first iterated amplitude.
That was my question.
It would be interesting to consider
iterations or
not. Yeah, that will perhaps affect, but we do not know.
This kind of iterations, could one also use instead something like a variation principle?
Yes, that would be
so interesting. So there's a Schwinger variation
principle. Yes, I think.
I I have some point with this across the clears the variations, so it reproduces the Warren series to cloth over. So that.
That would be interesting. If we have a gross variation of principle, we will use that to produce. But I think right there is a good one that I could also apply this kind of thing within a variation principle and see if I can get something more stable or easily.
Let's thank Prabhupada again.